I next met with Dr. Jyothi Patel, and we chatted about her research interests, beginning with women who develop lung cancer.
So 10, 15 years ago, lung cancer was certainly a disease that we equated with the Marlboro man. Men were overly represented. In the past decade or so, the proportion of women in the lung cancer population has increased astronomically. In fact, we've described a 600% increase in about four decades. And now men and women have parity in incidence. And unfortunately, that means in mortality. Women make up 50 to 60% of my practice, and this poses challenges as we try to interpret the literature. Certainly, studies that are one or two decades old often have much lower proportions of women. Studies that are done in Eastern Europe, for example, will have women representing maybe 30 or 40% of patients. And so how we bring our knowledge to an American population in which men and women are equally represented and generalize those results can be certainly challenging. I think what's more interesting is that perhaps, although men and women have equal incidence and probably equal risk, the way they develop lung cancer may be different. We know that, for example, women with stage 1 lung cancer were more likely to have a RAS mutation in resected specimens despite equal amounts of smoking history. And certainly one wonders if RAS mutation could be mediated in some part by estrogen receptor. There's been nice work in the past, and the breast cancer literature is full of this with EGFR, the relationship between EGFR and ER, where you can have upregulation of ER receptor and downregulation of EGFR. Certainly in lung cancer, we haven't seen that. But what has been described is classical ER receptor on a variety of lung cancers, including adeno and squamous histology. I think also interesting work from Jill Siegfried looked at ER beta receptor, and that's sort of a primordial ER that we think is important for early differentiation. There have been some nice correlations between lung differentiation and survival and ER beta expression. Suffice it to say, I think we're just touching the early stages of this research. Estrogen certainly is a growth factor and can likely work through multiple other signaling pathways in lung cancer. So there's increasing evidence in breast cancer with insulin growth factor receptor. Certainly, it's been an interesting signaling pathway in lung cancer. The relationship between endogenous hormone and estradiol levels is just beginning to be discovered. There have been some studies from, again, Jill Siegfried and Ann Trainer at Madison looking at estrogen antagonists with erlotinib, and those have shown some interesting results. But certainly, you know, we need to capitalize on what we know about this pathway and query a little bit further. In terms of outcome, it's interesting because although we think women have a different way of getting lung cancer and perhaps more molecular alterations, they also seem to have a protective pathway. So regardless of histology or stage of disease, women have a survival that's probably 20 to 30% better than men. With early stage disease, with early stage small cell or late stage small cell, women always live longer. What's interesting is their response to chemotherapy has been pretty equivalent over the years, but women have different toxicity. An interesting analysis was just published by Julie Brommer looking at the efficacy of bevacizumab in 4599 and looking at whether women really reaped the same benefits from bevacizumab as did men. And certainly, preliminarily, it doesn't look like they do. They had higher response rates, higher progression-free survival, but overall survival in both arms was similar. Subsequent therapies have been implicated. Something that we don't know about the biology of disease have been implicated. It could be statistical chance, but certainly it should give us pause in how we interpret clinical trials.
Let's talk a little bit about your work and the paper you published in the JCO looking at the combination of pemetrexed, carboplatin, and bevacizumab as first-line therapy for non-small cell and the resultant point break study. Could you talk about the background for that work, what we know about that regimen right now, and about this trial?
Sure. So at our institution, we developed a single-arm phase 2 study looking at the combination of carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab. At the time, we were building upon work looking at carboplatin and paclitaxel and bevacizumab. It was before 4599 was positive when we put this LOI together. So we didn't know much about histology. We just knew that bevacizumab shouldn't be given to patients with squamous cell tumors. The eligibility criteria for our phase 2 study was very similar to 4599, so no brain metastasis, no anticoagulation. We looked at a well population, PS 0 to 1.
I guess I should interject. Of course, the 4599 study was the ECOG trial of carbapaclitaxel and bevacizumab.
It was very similar to it, and patients would get 6 cycles of chemotherapy. And we hypothesize that perhaps following patients with pemetrexed and bevacizumab maintenance would improve their survival. The idea was that pemetrexed was a little bit more gentle. It didn't have the toxicity that we see with neuropathy and myelosuppression, that we could perhaps give prolonged therapy to improve outcomes. Also, there was very little efficacy of single-agent activity of bevacizumab in non-small cell lung cancer. So we thought, certainly, we could only improve bevacizumab's efficacy by giving both. So in our 50 patients, we did at 3 institutions, at Northwestern, Rush University Medical Center, and North Shore Health Center. We accrued patients fairly rapidly. We were very impressed with the toxicity. Patients seemed to have just modest toxicity. We saw very low incidence of myelosuppression. And we were more impressed with the tremendous responses we saw. Over half of patients had radiographic responses. Overall survival ended up being about 14 months. There was an interesting toxicity for which we stopped the trial, and that was a development of diverticulitis. It happened in 3 patients. We had 1 grade 4 event, and it wasn't really clear because we did have PATH on that patient. It didn't seem to be a vasculitic phenomenon. It was just plain old diverticulitis. So we amended the study so that patients with a history of diverticulitis could no longer go on. But after that, we saw no other toxicity.
I'm trying to think whether I've heard about problems with diverticulitis in Bev. Is that what you were thinking?
Exactly. The patients who developed diverticulitis didn't really have tifolitis or neutropenia. It wasn't like you would see with perhaps a docetaxel. We really thought that it was microabscess, and that's probably not the people that you should give Bev to anyway. So we didn't have a problem taking it out of the study. But we were encouraged. Certainly this seemed like a very promising regimen. The toxicity seemed very promising, and so we've gone forward to develop this phase 3 trial that's completed accrual, JMHD, or Point Break. Point Break is, you know, from surfing, and being from Chicago, I know all about surfing, or not. But the idea is it was sort of riding the wave.
Yeah, I was always curious about that. I've asked people, and they haven't been really sure. The idea of riding the wave, in other words, is kind of like the maintenance thing?
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
That makes sense. I like it.
So in the study, in Point Break, we have 900 individuals. Patients are randomized to Alan Sandler's 4599 regimen of carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, or carboplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab. Differences are that patients only get 4 cycles up front, so sort of the induction arm, and then either they go on to maintenance Bev or they go on to maintenance Pem Bev. Patients, at that point, we had good safety data regarding brain metastasis, so patients could have treated brain metastasis. Again, patients with diverticulitis were excluded. But the study accrued actually very rapidly and ahead of schedule. We finished in September, and now we're just waiting. The primary endpoint is overall survival. We're hitting a pretty high mark, I think. The survival goal is looking at 30% improvement or 15-month survival. So we have to make it on 2 marks, you know. Certainly, I think the toxicity one is easy, but that's a pretty ambitious survival, and I certainly feel good about it. If we're giving that much therapy, we better really push the field forward.
But just to clarify, in one arm, the patients get pemetrexed, carboplatin, Bev, and then go on to Pem-Bev maintenance.
Right.
The other arm, they get the Sandler paclitaxel carbo Bev with Bev maintenance. So I guess you are not addressing the question of the patient who might get the Sandler regimen, paclitaxel carboplatin bevacizumab, followed by Pem-Bev.
Exactly. And that is certainly, you know, initially we had planned a 3-arm study to the NCI, and we were told that we should probably just do a 2-arm study and get 1 question. I think, again, it answers 1 question, not all of the questions.
That's fantastic that you got 900 patients. It's almost unbelievable when you think about it. It's a huge study for lung cancer, for any cancer, really.
And we were thrilled, and it was an easy trial for patients to do. I mean, they were very excited about the results they'd seen.
Any guesses about when we might see some data from this?
We're hoping 2012.
What about your own observations, or maybe you have data from this trial in terms of quality of life side effects, particularly on the maintenance phase, PEM-BEV versus BEV?
We have not yet shared the data locks, but I can speak to my anecdotal experience. Certainly, patients, I think, who have controlled disease tend to do pretty well. Most patients who get prolonged pemetrexed, in my experience, do okay. There are maybe 5 or 7% of patients who have a tremendous amount of fatigue and usually find those patients out early. To me, it's not so much cumulative. So if you get patients through even the first couple of cycles of induction, you'll know whether or not they tolerate this regimen. We had patients who were on our phase 2 study on the pemetrexed for over 50 cycles of therapy. What was, I think, even more interesting and really speaks to why I'm excited about this approach is that in almost 20% of patients, after we stopped carboplatin, we continued to see a response with single-agent PEM and BEV, and we had further reductions in tumor burden. And, you know, across other tumor types, we certainly do prolonged therapy. There are very few cancers in the metastatic setting that we do only induction therapy and then back down. I think in lung cancer, the challenge has been that we have a sicker population, and so far, our agents have been fairly toxic.
What are your thoughts about the issue of maintenance therapy in general? There has been the question of, well, suppose you just follow the patient very closely and at the earliest sign of progression, start second-line therapy.
The maintenance question is hard on a couple of reasons. So there's, I think what you're referring to is something we call switch maintenance, which may be early second-line therapy. So that means giving induction or initial treatment with 4 to 6 cycles of therapy. And then the approved regimens we have, or approved drugs, have all been approved based upon a switch paradigm where you have induction therapy, and then you follow them either with erlotinib or pemetrexed at the completion of that. And in those studies, we saw survival benefits. Certainly, that is a reasonable approach. Many would argue, though, that if you followed a patient closely and you saw them every month and did a scan or a chest x-ray reasonably often, that you would be able to find their minimal progression before they became symptomatic and get equal amounts of drug into them, and the survival would be similar. We know from the Phidias trial, patients who had early docetaxel versus later docetaxel had similar survival if they got the docetaxel. The problem is that catastrophic events happen and 30% of people never get on to that second line drug. I think what we can say from the maintenance literature as it stands, particularly in switch maintenance, is that we have active second line therapies. The issue is timing. Now, there are people who need a break from treatment, that they've become very symptomatic from therapy. They've received perhaps carboplatin and a taxane up front. They've had myelosuppression and neuropathy. And after 4 to 6 cycles, you realize that you've changed the quality of their life and they need some time to regroup. Those patients, I feel very good about giving a break and following them closely. There are patients who had essentially stable disease on initial therapy. And I'm worried that at any point, a little bit of growth could tip them over the edge such that they would become PS2 and they'd never reap the benefits of second-line therapy. Sometimes those patients I'll put on switch maintenance early. For patients who have had disease response to chemotherapy up front, who've had a really nice response to initial therapy, often I find that continuation of the first drug makes sense. And certainly with pemetrexed, many of us have been doing that, although there's really been no phase 3 data showing that that improves survival. We have data with gemcitabine, and those show trends towards better survival, particularly the Bradowich study with cisgem followed by gem, a 2-month benefit, but it was not statistically significant. I think we don't have enough data in continuation maintenance to make a really good argument for it. But intuitively, again, pulling from other tumors, it seems to make sense. It works. If something is shrinking a tumor, why take it away?
Can you talk a little bit about your approach to EGFR mutation testing and how you manage the patient who has a mutation up front in the metastatic setting?
So certainly over the past several years, we have realized that probably the biggest predictor of survival in patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer is whether or not they have the presence of an activating mutation, which sensitizes them to particular drugs. In patients that we see, we try to obtain adequate tissue to get those results. Unfortunately, for many of us, that can take several weeks. And sometimes with very ill patients, we don't have the luxury of waiting. I think the way I approach classifying non-small cell lung cancer is that in patients who do not have squamous tumors, so adenocarcinoma or any non-squamous tumors, I try my best to do genotyping, meaning that we see what tissue is available and send it. In patients in whom I think there's a very high likelihood of having an EGFR mutation, if they've had perhaps a thoracentesis as their one diagnosis and just had a few malignant cells. So if the likelihood of having a mutation in my mind is 50-50, I would certainly ask that patient whether they would consider a repeat biopsy or a more invasive biopsy. But we don't certainly test in patients with squamous cell cancer. If there are those individuals who are never smokers who have squamous cell cancer, those individuals I'll test. But again, I think the yield is pretty low. I usually don't test active smokers up front unless, you know, they've had a surgical specimen and it's easy to obtain. There are instances, and I think all of us face these, is that unfortunately we don't diagnose lung cancer often until it's symptomatic. And so patients come to us with pleural effusion or chest pain or some event that needs treatment quickly. And we're faced with how long can I wait until I get mutation results versus do I just begin empiric chemotherapy? Maybe 2 years ago, if I had a never smoker who had a large effusion and maybe some clotting issues or brain metastasis, I would say, I don't know the mutation status. Certainly, let's move on with erlotinib, and then we'll find the mutation status and change chemotherapy appropriately. My practice has changed 100%. In those patients, I would only give chemotherapy at this juncture. And not until I found out that they had a mutation would I give them erlotinib in the frontline setting.
I was going to ask you about that. I don't know how often it happens, either referral or in patients you're already treating, that they're in the middle of chemo, let's say bevacizumab, and then you find they have a mutation. Do you add in their erlotinib? There are a lot of possibilities. How do you kind of think that through?
So if a patient has had some chemotherapy and is responding, I usually continue it. I usually end up doing 4 cycles. And based on the Saturn data, where the hazard ratio in giving maintenance erlotinib was 0.1, I feel very comfortable about waiting and switching them immediately. I mean, you decrease their chance of death by 90% by getting their erlotinib to them.
Now, is that with Bev, for example? Or do you stop the Bev?
The Saturn data was not with Bev.
I'm saying, what do you do? I mean, do you keep the Bev going and add in erlotinib? Do you stop the Bev?
Can I hedge?
Sure. So, well, I'm sure it's individual based on the patient.
Right. So if a patient has had a really robust response to therapy, developed hypertension with the bevacizumab, but has had no other toxicity, then I'd probably continue the Bev and add erlotinib. For most patients, however, I think finding that you have an EGFR mutation really gives you the chance to scale away unnecessary therapy and perhaps give those patients a chance to just be on oral chemotherapy alone and a break from infusional treatment.
I have to ask you, because we've worked a lot with Mario Lacouture, who's now at Memorial, but previously was with you, and you've always had a really strong dermatologic oncology program there at Northwestern. How do you approach right now the issue of dermatologic toxicity, prevention, and treatment with erlotinib?
I learned a lot from Mario over the years. So when we start a patient on erlotinib, they have an automatic referral to dermatology. John Collier came from UCLA recently, and he's been leading our efforts. So patients are educated early on. Many of them will leave clinic with antibiotic prescriptions. They have very clear nursing instructions. In patients who are mutation positive, I mean, we see a lot of toxicity. So toxicity that I don't think patients are really prepared for. We'll say, oh, you have some rash and diarrhea. But then the toxicities, for example, for women who are chronically on erlotinib, many of them develop alopecia, many of them develop a lot of facial hair. Mario and I did a study looking at about 12 patients, a small number of patients, a pilot study, who had been on erlotinib for greater than 3 months, women. And at the time, we didn't know the mutation story, but in these women, almost universally, they had truncal weight gain, they developed hyperglycemia. We looked at their lipids, and it looked like their triglycerides went up and their insulin levels went up. You know, we don't understand why. Certainly they look a little bit like they have metabolic syndrome or polycystic ovarian disease, which has sort of the same phenotype. I wonder if metformin would be a good drug for these patients, similar to patients with some of the metabolic syndromes. But many of our patients feel like they look very different than they did before they started their erlotinib. I mean, certainly they're very happy to be on what they consider a life-saving drug, but it can be difficult over time, and the cumulative toxicity at 1 and 2 years can't be overlooked.
That's interesting. I've never heard that before. So you don't see this in men?
I think we're swayed because I tend to see a lot of women, more women probably in Chicago with mutations than in other parts of the world. But certainly we've seen it a little bit more in men, and it's a little bit more obvious. You know, when a woman develops frontal balding, she notices more than a man probably, and she starts having to shave every day.
That's fascinating. Have you actually tried metformin?
We haven't, but, you know, metformin is probably good in a lot of cancer things.
Right. And how, again, I'm not sure I've heard anybody talk about alopecia. How extensive can it be?
I've had, particularly in some of my Asian patients who are mutation positive, we've had total alopecia.
Wow.
Now, with the other part of it is that you have incredible trichomegaly. So you have trichomegaly, you have facial hair, and then alopecia.
So the idea of the connection with the mutation, I assume, is just because they're on it longer, or is there more of a susceptibility?
They're on it longer, and I think that they probably don't need as much drug. I usually start patients who are mutation positive and of smaller stature or more petite. I might start them at 100 instead of 150, but they're still probably getting a lot more drug than they would need, I think.
I'm curious. I see that you're the protocol chair of a phase 2 study looking at BLP25, liposomal vaccine, and bevacizumab. What is this agent, and what are you looking at in this study?
So BLP25 is a MUC vaccine. There has been a randomized phase 2 experience that was reported by Charles Butts and JCO looking at patients who had at least localized cancer and had had some radiation. When they took out patients with the locally advanced disease cohort, they found an improvement in survival in these patients. And that has led to a large phase 3 trial, the SMART trial, which is currently ongoing and accruing slowly, but in patients who get definitive chemoradiation. The idea of the MUC vaccine is that these glycoproteins are expressed on almost all non-small cell lung cancer. Administration of the vaccine is interesting because we give a little bit of cyclophosphamide prior to the vaccine administration to increase the immunogenicity of the vaccine. The vaccine is given as 4 injections every 3 weeks initially and then every 6 weeks, and we're hoping we'll see some nice results. The really interesting part of this study, however, is incorporation of bevacizumab with the vaccine. So this is looking at patients who've undergone definitive chemoradiation. And we did it like a lot of people in the community do it. We're giving a la LAMP, where we're giving weekly paclitaxel and carboplatin, followed by consolidation carboplatin and paclitaxel. And then upon that completion of those 2 cycles after definitive chemoradiation, we started administering bevacizumab for 2 years with vaccine. And this is interesting in 2 ways. One, we need to establish safety data with bevacizumab after radiation. Clearly, you know the story with the T. fistulas. Sort of everything stopped about 2 years ago in development of bevacizumab with radiation. We're doing this a little bit farther out, and we hope that we decrease the chance of any problems. We know that patients who develop bad esophagitis during chemoradiation really can't go on. So if they have grade 3 esophagitis, they are off study and don't receive the bevacizumab. The work for bevacizumab really comes from Dave Carbone's laboratory, in which he has shown that bevacizumab increases T-cell function and antigen presentation. And so we think that this will make the vaccine more effective. And that's one of the issues, is that the vaccines have never developed enough of immune response to improve survival.
You keep saying things that I've never heard before. Bev affects immune function?
That's the work that Dave Carbone has shown, this T-cell activation.
That's fascinating. How is this vaccine actually prepared? Is it individualized to the patient, or is it the same vaccine for everybody?
Same vaccine for everyone.
And how exactly do they make it? And you say it's against the MUC antigen?
Right. So it's an anti-MUC antibody.
And has that been used in other tumor types? Because there are a lot that have the MUC antibody.
It's been looked at in breast cancer, in ovarian cancer, and in myeloma.
any activity in any of those diseases?
Again, some early activity. I think lung has been the most promising.
How many patients have you had on the study so far?
So the study just opened after sort of heroic efforts for 2 years with dealing with two companies for a small trial. So the study just opened around Christmas, and we're hoping that we'll get our first patient on in the next couple of weeks.
Fascinating. What do we know about side effects and toxicity of the vaccine alone or with Bev?
The vaccine has been generally well tolerated across multiple studies. There were some incidents of autoimmune phenomena on the SMART trial. One patient developed a hepatitis, autoimmune hepatitis. One patient had problems with platelets, so thrombocytopenia, and another patient developed encephalitis. It was not clear whether any of these were related to the vaccine, but certainly there's very strong language in our protocol that if there's any immune-related phenomenon, we need to know. The FDA had stopped all Stimuvax trials for some time to really analyze those cases and felt it was safe to proceed. With bevacizumab, we don't have much data. This will be new.
Really fascinating. Let's talk about your cases, beginning with the 63-year-old man.
Sure. So this is a gentleman who, very active, was a marathon runner, a physician daughter, who had never smoked and developed a seizure. He was found to have solitary brain met with substantial edema as well as a left lower lobe mass with some hilar lymphadenopathy and a question of a liver lesion. Because of the location of the tumor in his brain, it was felt that resection would be difficult despite having the symptoms, and so he was treated with stereotactic radiosurgery. After we verified that he had non-small cell lung cancer and adenocarcinoma. So this is a gentleman that at the time we put on our phase 2 clinical trial of carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab. And he had a really, really robust response. He had a CR in his liver, a CR with all of his hilar nodes. He was on treatment for about 2.5 years and continued to feel well. He is active and still running. After about 2.5 years, he developed a little bit of renal insufficiency and intermittent proteinuria with the pemetrexed and bevacizumab, so we had some skip doses. And when we took a good hard look at his CTs, we really found no evidence of disease outside of his lung nodule. At that point, he wanted a break from chemotherapy, wanted to do some more traveling, and so we performed SBRT to his remaining lung lesion after performing a PET that disclosed no other evidence of disease. He has been off of all treatment now for a year, and he's doing quite well. So I think this is an interesting case on many fronts. I mean, this was a man who presented with CNS symptoms, and generally we think that if someone presents with a seizure and is postictal for a couple of days, that they'll never do very well. But he did with stereotactic radiosurgery. We were able to get him on bevacizumab because he had had a nice response. He, again, had very little toxicity and really maintained a nice response. I think one of the interesting questions is, are there patients in whom local control is important? And I would argue that this is one of them. This is a man in whom we really understood the biology after about 2 years of treatment and said that he was not going to have further disease, and we were able to get him to something definitive. He understands that this is, you know, a little bit of cherry picking, but he's optimistic.
And you're seeing him tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a lot of respect for people who focus on lung cancer, just, you know, emotionally, what it must be like to just deal with lung cancer patient after lung cancer patient. I guess he must be one of the highlights of your clinic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I always tell him he's the healthiest guy. He's like, I had cancer in my brain.
Any speculation about why, you know, what might differentiate him biologically or the treatment compared to the other 99% of people who would never have done this well?
No idea. No idea. And, you know, we did check after we learned about ALK fusion. He doesn't have it. So he has no detectable mutations that we know of. When we first met him, I mean, he had biologically active disease. His PET was quite avid. But luckily, we have a fair amount of tumor on this gentleman. We've had multiple biopsies over the years to get more tissue. Hopefully, we'll know one day.
So what about your 50-year-old woman with cardiac tamponade? That caught my interest.
So this is a 50-year-old female, never smoker. She presented with extreme shortness of breath and tamponade. She almost had a miliary pattern of lung cancer. She was found to have adenocarcinoma. She had a pericardiocentesis, and she did not have a window because she didn't reaccumulate after a couple of days. So as soon as I had her information, I was faced with, you know, she's someone who's very likely to have a mutation. Should I treat her empirically with erlotinib, or should I give her chemotherapy? After multiple discussions, it was clear to me that I should give her cisplatin pemetrexed. As soon as we drained her effusion, she felt much better, and she actually walked into clinic 2 days later for the chemotherapy. But this is certainly not a patient that I would have felt comfortable waiting 1 to 2 additional weeks for to get the right genotyping. And even in an academic institution, it takes me some time to get this data. If you're not doing these genotyping studies in-house, it can take anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks to have your pathologist send the slides to the appropriate outside lab and get the results. It's certainly labor-intensive. A woman like this would have likely developed another pericardial effusion if we'd waited around. So I treated her with cisplatin and pemetrexed. She had a very nice response to initial therapy. But during her first cycle, I found out that she had an exon 19 mutation. Again, we talked about whether we should give her all drugs. And remember the data from Tribute, which I know you're familiar with, but that's the study that did carboplatin and paclitaxel with or without erlotinib. In the never-smoking cohort of that population, their overall survival with all three drugs was 22 months. That's better than any other study. Those are the best survivals we've seen. I mean, certainly it's closer to what we see on IPASS and other EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor studies. But she and I decided together that because she was responding to the cisplatin and pemetrexed, she was breathing better after a couple of weeks from her treatment, that we would just wait and we would give her erlotinib afterwards. She's now been on erlotinib for roughly 6 months, and she's doing quite well. So she had a nice response with the cisplatin and pemetrexed. When we put her on erlotinib, she had minimal disease burden at that time, so it was difficult to see how much of a response she's had, but she's been feeling quite well. And so she is one of those patients that switch maintenance is absolutely appropriate for.
How is she doing in terms of dermatologic toxicity and these other things you were talking about?
She is a blue-eyed, red-haired woman whose skin was falling off a little bit. I mean, we've dropped her down to 100 milligrams. She follows with our dermatology clinic and now is doing quite well. She is on chronic doxycycline and is able to take care of her flares. She's done some laser therapy for her hair growth. She's had some hair growth on her chin, which she thinks has helped a lot.
And any of the truncal obesity or the other problems you were talking about?
No, she has not had that problem.
And I'm guessing that you generally use carbo in first-line metastatic disease. You use cis because of the sort of desperate situation?
Exactly. As soon as we drained her pericardial fluid, her PS was pretty close to zero, so we gave her cisplatin. I do believe that there are a few individuals, and I can count the number on my hand every year, in whom I think cisplatin up front is appropriate. And I would absolutely agree with you that for most of our patients in which we are trying to make their lives better and their quality of life better, and in which we're really palliating chronic disease, carboplatin is the appropriate drug.
How about your 48-year-old woman with adeno metastatic to the liver?
So this was a patient who had a smoking history but had quit about 15 years ago. She had had her diagnosis from a core biopsy of her liver. We did not have her mutation results, but she wanted to go ahead and go on study. So she was treated on Point Break on JMHD and was randomized to the control arm. She got carboplatin and paclitaxel for 4 cycles with the bevacizumab and then stayed on bevacizumab. And she actually was on bevacizumab for 9 weeks with stable disease. She developed a little bit of hypertension. So she ended up having to be on a diuretic every day. She had like grade 2 hypertension. So I felt that the bevacizumab was important for her. And this comes from Suzanne Dahlberg's analysis of 4599, where onset of hypertension after first cycle was the best predictor of survival in patients who received bevacizumab. You're very familiar, Neil, I'm sure, with similar results, or more familiar than me, across renal cell cancer, in which hypertension is an important predictor. But certainly, I thought bevacizumab was important for her. When she developed progression, she developed in the liver and lung, I was faced with whether or not I could sort of abide to a protocol violation and continue her bevacizumab or to change her to what was probably a very appropriate second-line therapy. I decided to give her pemetrexed alone, again, which is sort of the standard treatment. And she's just finishing two cycles. She's tolerated them well, and we'll see how she's doing. But certainly this was one of those patients that I had that internal discussion, you know, is this a patient that would benefit from Bev? Now, we don't know so much about Bev in subsequent lines of therapy. We have data from Vince Miller's ATLAS study, and we have the older beta study looking at continuation of bevacizumab. I don't think we know as much what patients to do this in. Certainly, it seems that PFS has improved.
I just want to clarify, though, when she developed the progression, she was on Bev alone?
Yes.
And then you stopped the Bev and put her on PEM?
Right.
And you're raising the question of whether maybe you could have continued the Bev and added the PEM in.
Exactly.
Anything else you want to say about her?
She didn't have an activating mutation in EGFR. And again, this is sort of standard practice now for our center.
You mentioned the ALK mutation, and I'm curious right now how you are approaching sort of the algorithm. I've heard people talk about doing, first you do the EGFR mutation, and if that's negative in a non-smoker, then you do the ALK. I've heard people talk about KRAS. I think there's a lot of heterogeneity in what people do. What do you do?
I think we can all agree that all of these mutations are mutually exclusive, and in the perfect world, we'd have RAS testing on Monday, EGFR testing on Tuesday, and ALK testing on Wednesday, and have an answer every week by Thursday. Unfortunately, that probably isn't what happens. When I'm impatient, I get everything at once, meaning that if I have a patient in whom I really feel that we need to make treatment decisions quickly, I'll go ahead and order all three, but those are redundant, and we pay for all of them separately. I mean, now we'll look at platforms probably in the coming years in which we do inclusive testing where that's part of a panel. But right now, those are ordered at my institution individually, and they're paid for. What I usually do, what we do for resected specimens now, where with anatomic pathology, we have a little bit more time, we do sequential testing where we do RAS, EGFR, and then ALK. RAS doesn't help much in decision-making up front. If they're positive, we stop all testing. And I'm someone who sort of believes that patients who have RAS mutations tend to be less responsive to erlotinib. So erlotinib goes from a second-line option to maybe a third or lower-line option.
If you do have a patient who has an ALK mutation, do you have a local trial, or how do you deal with that in terms of making access to crizotinib?
We are just opening a new ALK trial. Right now, we're working with Ravi Salgia at University of Chicago. He has a couple of phase one trials for patients who've had multiple lines of treatment, and then patients who are willing to be randomized in the second line trial of docetaxel or pemetrexed with ALK. We're trying to get more patients to him for that. So we are working with University of Chicago, and Ravi's been terrific and has really led a lot of these efforts.
I had heard people talking about the fact that there's some kind of a test for ALK that was somehow going to be incorporated into some of these new trials. And I've heard a concern verbalized about using your tissue up for the sort of commercially available ALK and then having to repeat it, not have enough tissue for a trial. Is that a reality?
It absolutely is. I mean, it's, you know, lung cancer is oftentimes we end up with outside cases in which patients have had just an FNA or one core biopsy, and by the time that you do histo, a little bit of immunohistochemistry, and then you start looking for these special molecular tests, you really do use up tissue. Right now, what needs to come into place is a standardized testing for both EGFR and for ALK, perhaps linking approval of drugs to particular testing will make that a little bit easier. One of the things with ALK is I think there's still equipoise about FISH versus IHC. Right now, we know that for the ongoing crizotinib trials, the phase three trials, that there has to be testing locally for the trial exactly as you said. And so we are still doing that idea that we sort of screen and then send, but there are those that believe that everyone should be tested.
The last thing I want to ask you about is you mentioned testing on resected specimens, and I'm curious what your current approach is to selection of patients for adjuvant therapy and selection of regimen.
So we are actively participating in Heather Wakely's study in 1505, which is picking up accrual and moving along. And 1505 is a bevacizumab study, so 1,500 patients with stage 1B tumors, those are greater than 4 centimeters, to stage 3A tumors in patients who aren't going to have radiation, are randomized to chemotherapy versus bevacizumab. The chemotherapy is dealer's choice. You can do cisvenorelbine, cisgemcitabine, cisdocetaxel, or cispemetrexed if you have a non-squamous tumor. The bevacizumab continues after the 4 cycles of adjuvant chemotherapy for a year.
I'm kind of curious and maybe going to make a guess, but in terms of what you usually select?
So for patients with non-squamous tumors, I almost always do cisplatin pemetrexed. And for patients with squamous tumors, I generally do cisplatin docetaxel. If they have questions about alopecia, we'll do cisplatin and gemcitabine. I really don't treat many patients with cisvenorelbine despite having truly the data there. I think it's difficult therapy for our patients. And more importantly, I think we may find that it's not as good as some of our modern regimens.
Do you know what the current accrual to 1505 is? How many people have been put on?
I think it's over 1,000.
Really?
Yeah.
Impressive.